Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as we told you just moments ago, President Bush named Donna Shalala, the former Health and Human Services Administrator or Administration Secretary from the Clinton administration. Remember, she once used to be president of Hunter College here in New York as well. So Donna Shalala and Bob Dole, the former Republican Senate Majority Leader, to co-chair a commission to investigate the Walter Reed Army Hospital conditions and, in general, Army hospitals and the treatment of war wounded. Now, with this and other things, the Bush administration has been getting some points in the media, even on Morning Edition today, for acting quickly to address this scandal. But it's not necessarily true. As retired Army Major General Paul Eaton writes in today's New York Times, Salon.com and the group Veterans for America have been reporting on the disgraceful treatment of war wounded since 2003. So we are going to speak to the reporter who first broke this story, and we're also going to open up the phones now for any currently serving members of the U.S. military, active duty or reserves, or any Iraq war veterans to call up and talk about your treatment by the military health system or the VA system. Call and tell us how much of a surprise any of this is to you and what else you think we should know about it. 212-433-WNYC. 433-9692. First call for anyone currently serving as active duty military or in the reserves, or anyone who has served in Iraq, or anyone with experience being treated by the military health system or the VA system. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And joining me now, we are very happy to have Mark Benjamin, national correspondent for Salon.com. Mark, welcome to WNYC. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
So when did you first report on the treatment of Iraq war wounded?
My first article was back when I was with United Press International, the wire service. It was in the fall of 2003. It was dateline Fort Stewart, Georgia, where I reported. It was back, actually a headline very similar to one of the headlines that appeared in the Post recently about Walter Reed. It was something like sick wounded troops held in squalor. It was soldiers, outpatient soldiers, once again, who were in, I think squalid is the right word, you know, buildings without running water and without air conditioning and so on and so forth at Fort Stewart, Georgia. But more importantly, they were waiting a long time for doctor's appointments, and they were really not happy with the compensation they were getting from the Army. I wrote the same thing from Fort Knox. And I also wrote very similar stories in 2005 and 2006 on Walter Reed. And I think that's probably what the New York Times is referring to all those articles today.
What was the official reaction like at the time?
At the time, whenever possible, in my opinion, the military has tried to essentially deny that there was a problem. I mean, for example, in early 2005, I wrote an article that I had researched for months and months and months about soldiers with psychological injuries, post-traumatic stress disorder, not getting proper treatment, waiting at Walter Reed for months, in some cases years, and not being properly compensated. And I essentially got a statement from the Army that said, "You're wrong. Everything, all is well at Walter Reed." Occasionally, they will, you know, have a press conference and say, "Oh, we're going to fix it," you know, and they usually put some paint on the walls. But in general, there's generally been a denial from the military.
So, how much was new in the Washington Post series that really made this explode onto the scene?
Well, I think one thing is it's the Washington Post. I mean, the Washington Post is a very powerful publication. Everybody reads it. I think that people were really shocked at some of the living conditions in one of these buildings called Building 18. It's just across the street from Walter Reed. And that sort of gave the story a lot of play. Interestingly enough, if you talk to soldiers, things like, you know, bad living conditions, mice and mold, that, of course, that bothers them. It's insulting. But what they're really concerned about is waiting for doctor's appointments, not getting the proper outpatient care, and not being properly compensated for their wounds while they wait for months and months and months. That's really the story, and I think that people are starting to figure that out. And by the way, it's not just Walter Reed. You know, it's Fort Knox and Fort Stewart and these other installations as well.
So do you think you weren't taken seriously when you first broke the story because you were writing for something like UPI or Salon and not the Washington Post, or were there also other reasons?
Well, it's unclear. I think one of the things that is definitely true is that the public has become more and more willing, frankly, to pay attention to bad news stories about the war. I mean, as public opinion has shifted, people are more willing to accept those kinds of things. And I think also that reporters and editors are more likely to write those stories, and people are more likely to read them. So it's, in other words, when I first wrote my story about Fort Stewart in October of 2003, it was very similar to what we're hearing now. I got hundreds of emails of people calling me a communist and a liar and all this other stuff. I don't get those kinds of reactions anymore when I write these stories. I get really positive feedback.
Right. I'm almost surprised that some paper like the Washington Post didn't pick up on your reporting at the time and go and confirm it for themselves, or at least in, the months or couple of years thereafter, once Abu Ghraib happened and other things happened that made it kind of okay to report negative things about the war. And I don't have to tell you, this frequently happens when a news outlet like Salon or some other comes up with a really interesting story that doesn't quite crack the national radar because it's not the Washington Post or the New York Times. Then the Washington Post or the New York Times or ABC News or NPR goes out and does it and breaks it wider. But for some reason, nobody did that with your stuff.
And I think one of the reasons why is that the military had a very effective tool for controlling the coverage on this issue, and this is how it worked. If I write a story showing that there's these horrible outpatient problems at a place like Walter Reed, when other reporters come to Walter Reed, and, I was not working at Walter Reed through the public affairs people. I was working directly with the soldiers. But if you're a reporter from the New York Times and you call Walter Reed, you've read Mark Benjamin's story on problems there, what the people do who run Walter Reed is they bring the New York Times reporters in, they bring them to the inpatient ward where care is excellent. Remember, there's two different stories here. One is the inpatient stuff is going really well. The outpatient stuff is what is a disaster. They bring these folks up to the Ward 57 or one of the amputee wards, which are fabulously run, gleaming and spit polished. They introduce these reporters to pre-screened soldiers who say really wonderful things and that they want to get back to their units and so on and so forth. And they tell the reporters, see, there's no problem here at Walter Reed. Look how wonderful everything is going. And the reporter leaves with essentially a very just a view of one little part of the inpatient story, when in fact, in all the buildings surrounding the main hospital there, that's where all the outpatients are sitting there for months, sitting up at night drinking beer, taking too many meds, and not getting a doctor's appointment.
And the reporter, in many cases, doesn't know enough to ask the question to determine the difference between inpatient and outpatient care. In fact, in the New York Times op-ed piece today by General Eaton, which gives you a shout-out, he says, soldiers have long joked, if you are really sick or injured, Army medical care is okay. But if you are hurting only a little, especially if it isn't visible, you're in big trouble.
Well, that's right. And in fact, the military does deserve kudos for their acute care on the battlefield. So if you do lose a leg in Iraq, the care that you are going to receive from on the ground in Iraq through Lonsdale back to Walter Reed inpatient is absolutely excellent, top shelf. The problem is once those people move out of inpatient to outpatient care, or people that were never in inpatient care for very long in the first place, people with post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injuries that are, it's not an open head wound, wounds that you can't easily see, those are the lion's share of injuries. There's many, many more of those soldiers than the people without legs. And those are the people that are stuck in this bureaucratic nightmare at places like Walter Reed and Fort Stewart and Fort Knox and Fort Carson.
Mark Benjamin, my guest on WNYC, the journalist who first broke the story of the treatment of our war wounded from the Iraq War in 2003, first writing for UPI, as he said, and then for Salon.com, where he still works. In fact, we'll get to his article that's out on Salon today that continues to follow up. But we also want your phone calls. Are you an Iraq War veteran? Are you active duty military or a member of the reserves or anyone else with stories to tell along these lines? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Margo in Piscataway, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. I'm just calling because I just want to make sure that this gets said from someone. I often feel like you were saying, that the people with the bad stories don't get heard. My husband is a veteran of the war in Afghanistan, and he was discharged in 2004. And he has been trying to get his claim heard, VA claim heard, ever since then. He's had his file lost. It's been bounced back and forth from you know, Indiana to here and there, Washington, D.C., numerous times. He's been literally dragged around about this claim ever since then, and it's just been a nightmare. Finally, I find this to be very ironic. Last month, we finally got a response just before this huge thing broke, and neither of us are surprised about this situation.
Margo, do you have any thought about why it's gone this way?
I don't. I mean, I think a lot of it may have to do with, like your guest was saying, the maximum of real problems are not visible problems, like post-traumatic stress disorder and things of that nature. These are things that are, I mean, you know, my husband is not, you know, mentally incapacitated, so he's able to really follow, you know, through the red tape and try and work this out. But I just think of the people who might really be incapacitated. I mean, these are the people that are going to end up on the streets because they can't find their way through the all of the bureaucratic red tape. The kinds of injuries that they're dealing with mostly now, I think, are really going to be mental injuries because of the long deployments, the high stress, the lack of enough troops, things like this. These are just recipes for disaster. My husband knows many friends who are still in the military who have been deployed now for years. Their marriages are broken. Their families are, I mean, these things are just the repercussions on society and, you know, that go on inside someone's head are the lion's share of the problem.
Right. And in fact, General Eaton, in that op-ed today in the Times, echoes exactly what you were saying. He writes, President Bush, former Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, and Congress all pointedly failed to provide the money and resources for our returned troops, wherever they are, both the obviously wounded and those who may seem healthy but are suffering mentally and physically from their service. And he says also there's been little preparation for identifying and treating post-traumatic stress injuries. So, Mark Benjamin, do you want to talk to Margo, react to her?
Right. I think she's absolutely right. I think it was in a very articulate way to put the problem. And just imagine the trap that she's describing. By the way, this kind of thing is extremely widespread. And what's happening is she's talking about the Department of Veterans Affairs, which is responsible for taking care of soldiers after they get out of the military. But imagine the trap that she's talking about. If you are a soldier who has a serious problem, a debilitating problem, particularly soldiers that are on their own that don't have good family support networks, and you do not get proper compensation from the military, which many, many soldiers believe they are not, or you just get frustrated with the bureaucracy and sign a piece of paper that says, forget about it, I'll just try my luck with the VA. When you go to the Department of Veterans Affairs, it could take months, it could take years to get your compensation. So all of a sudden, you're out of the military, you're unable to provide for yourself, you're not getting money from the Army, and you have to wait years for the VA.
You can't figure out why you can't focus or why you can't seem to get a job or why all of these things that are direct results of what may be your injuries are making it impossible for you to get through life out in civilian world. Not only that, but the things, finally, after the claim is heard, my husband's claim is heard, the things that he really feels are the problems were not granted him. Mm-hmm. His physical injuries that he had claimed were granted him, but the things that he really feels like are causing him issues were not. So that means we're going to have to reapply, do the entire game over again.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, I am absolutely certain that he has lots of company with this problem.
Margo, I'm going to go get some other people's stories,
okay.
But thank you.
Thank you, Ryan.
Told an important one. Thank you very much. Good
Bye-bye.
Luck to you and your husband.
Thanks.
And Frank in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Frank.
Yeah, I'm a physician that's taking care of Vietnam veterans, all kinds of veterans. And I want to tell you something. The reaction of the person taking care of a young person whose brain is damaged or who suffers from a very powerful disorder known as PTSD, it's not a light disorder, but the people taking care of these people become very despondent very quickly because they see what looks like a healthy body, and then they get the feeling that these people are malingering. They are very, very sick people. And what the problem, I believe, is what we used to call counter-transference, that they see these people as either malingering or not living up to their potential because of being pampered in some way, shape, or form. That's why the surroundings are always degraded. the people themselves who live in such surroundings are also accepting of this thing because they can't understand what's going on either. So I think the Army has got more than just a job of, you know, fixing buildings up and stuff like that, or money. It's not money. It's training people that they are in for the long haul and taking care of these people. These people cannot function on the outside, and no amount of external funding will change this. You've got to realize that that's a fact.
Frank, thank you very much. I'm going to go right on to Maureen in Westchester. Maureen, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Thank you, Brian. Hi. My husband was a physician in the Army, and I'm a nurse, and I always felt that it's almost like universal health care. People get lost in the system, and as you were saying earlier, the people who are not quite as sick wait online, and that's as much as I'd like to see. I'm very frustrated by health care in this country right now, and as much as I'd like to see everybody being taken care of, what happens is people are paid a salary to go in, meaning doctors or whatever, in the Army too, to day in, day out, take care of people, and other people get lost in this line. And I'm wondering what your writer feels about that, whether or not he understands that that's part of the problem that goes on.
Mark Benjamin?
Absolutely. I mean, that's precisely what's going on. And it's exacerbated in the military because they're, you know, having trouble keeping track of people almost physically. I mean, in other words, I can't tell you the number of people at, say, a place like Walter Reed who are up there that don't even have proof that they served in Iraq. I mean, in other words, they arrived in Lonsdale with the bloody clothes that they were wearing. There's no medical records. There's no proof of their deployment. You know, and the Army spends tremendous amounts of time, you know, just trying to figure out who they are and where they should be and so on and so forth. I mean, that's an extreme example of getting lost in the system. But yes, it's the outpatient system, at least at Walter Reed and other places, is overwhelmed, and people are falling through the cracks. There's not enough people. Perhaps it's a money issue, and there's not the sort of logistical setup there to make sure that people are guided efficiently through the outpatient care program and the program that's supposed to compensate them. So yes, they just sort of drift for months.
Maureen, you imply a whole other issue, because we are having a universal health care debate in this country right now, obviously.
Yeah.
And so you kind of imply that if we go toward a universal single-payer kind of plan or something with the government more involved, that the bureaucracy is likely to fail more people than just those in the military. Were you consciously going there?
Yes. Well, I have always felt that way. I mean, I am in favor of everyone having health care, but I also see this problem developing that scares me, that people will not, the people who really will need it, because once again, with universal health care, and I don't mean to go off on that topic, people who can afford to pay for medicine will pay for it, and everybody else is going to get lost in the shuffle.
But there is a difference, and obviously as a nurse you've thought about this. You have a physician husband, you say, who's treated veterans, worked in the system, so you've had experience with this. Isn't there a difference between care by the government, which is what we're seeing here, where the bureaucracy actually cares for the people, and something like Medicare, which is, you know, just a funding mechanism for you to go to private doctors, which some of the single-payer advocates say, well, that's what we should have, is Medicare for all.
Well, the problem with Medicare is as you can see over the years, from the time my husband started practice until now, is whenever the government decides that they're going to cut funding, they cut what they reimburse the doctors for. And believe me, I'm not on the stump for doctors' pay either.
Mm-hmm.
But it's at their discretion, and so they can wipe people out in practice who are really good physicians, but just can't make it because they can't get reimbursed for the time that they're putting in. So when the government does get involved, and because we're such a huge country, I mean, obviously I don't have the answer, but it does scare me because really the Army or the armed services are contained. And if we can't handle it in the armed services, what will we do
in the general population? Maureen, thank you very much. And I want to play. Mark, did you want to say something about that?
No, I think that's a very interesting point. You know, it's a little bit of a different ball of wax here what we're dealing with, because there's sort of this bargain, this implicit bargain that we say to people when they're going out to war. We're saying, we are going to ask you to put your life on the line and perhaps die to protect our Constitution. and in return, we're going to take care of you if things go wrong. I mean, that's a very strong bargain, and I think the soldiers who are at places like Walter believe, think very strongly that we need to follow through on it.
Right, but it is an argument, at least one argument, and maybe we'll follow up on a subsequent show and get multiple perspectives against the government being too involved in administering health care, that if the government can't take care even of these people who are the most valued by society, the war wounded, then how is it going to take care of everybody else? Not that the insurance companies take care of us that well either. But let me play a clip of President Bush from his appearance before the American Legion just minutes ago announcing a commission to look into this.
I've also directed the Secretary of Veterans Affairs to lead a task force composed of 7 members of my cabinet to focus and respond to immediate needs. We have an obligation, we have a moral obligation to provide the best possible care and treatment to the men and women who've served our country. They deserve it, and they're going to get it.
So he announced Bob Dole and Donna Shalala to lead a bipartisan commission to study the problem and recommend improvements. Your thoughts as somebody who's been covering this military war-wounded care story for 4 years?
My thoughts are that it's not Bob Dole that's interesting. It's that he said the panel is going to be led by the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs, Jim Nicholson. Jim Nicholson is a combat vet from Vietnam. I have to tell you, though, he's not an incredibly popular guy among veterans groups and among veterans. They believe he's also a former head of the Republican National Committee. He's a powerful Republican player. And there are a lot of people who believe that he has essentially told Congress year after year that the Department of Veterans Affairs has enough money, and they don't. And there are a lot of people that believe the Department of Veterans Affairs failed to plan adequately for these waves of problems like post-traumatic stress disorder it was very clear we were going to have these things very early on in the war. So, I think the controversial thing there is going to end up being the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Mark Benjamin has been covering this story since 2003, first for UPI, since then for Salon.com. His article up on Salon today is called Walter Reed on the Cheap. The Pentagon's top civilian official in charge of military health care wanted more money for bullets and bombs and fewer benefits for soldiers. Mark, very informative. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up, we will meet 3 artists from the PS1 series Emergency Room. They make art based on the headlines of the day. Stay with us.